From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. Terry Gross is off today, but we'll still bring you a couple of her interviews. Today, Terry talks with business consultant Grafe Crystal. For years, he lobbied on behalf of top executives, getting them larger and larger salaries. Now he speaks out against the huge salaries many CEOs get. Also today, we enter the world of women's underground comics. Artist Diane Newman's just edited a new collection of women's comics called Twisted Sisters. And world music critic Milo Miles checks out what they're listening to in Indonesia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In his first public assessment of the Soviet Union since taking office, the CIA director, Robert Gates, predicted the most significant civil disorder there this winter since the 1917 revolution. NPR's Ann Gerrels has more.
CIA Director Gates told the House Armed Services Committee Democratic forces could be overwhelmed by a return to authoritarian government. He detailed deteriorating discipline and morale in the Soviet military, matched by the lowest state of readiness in decades. He said the Soviet military is beginning to fragment into elements loyal to the republics or simply devoted to self-preservation. While the centralized command and control system continue to operate now, Gates said flatly, that center is evaporating before our very eyes. He referred to the disintegrating Soviet empire as a nuclear arsenal that used to be a country, and expressed concern about the safety of Soviet nuclear weapons in the future. He raised the prospect that nuclear-armed republics might decide to sell weapons or technology to the highest bidder. I'm Ann Gerrels in Washington.
Diplomats at the European Community Summit meeting in the Netherlands say that they've reached agreement in principle on all the outstanding issues in their negotiations toward a political and economic union. British officials said that a controversial section of the treaty that dealt with labor issues has been dropped. Britain has opposed community-wide laws on social policy and threatened to veto the treaty if it gave the community the authority to regulate labor laws. Sources said that Britain's 11 EC partners have issued a separate declaration committing themselves to strengthen their labor legislation. About 200 law enforcement officers have been searching the central Missouri town of California, Missouri, all day for a sniper who killed four people. Kathy Lohr reports.
Officers who set up roadblocks and have been using helicopters and teams of dogs have come up with nothing so far in the town of California, Missouri. But they still think the suspect, James Johnson, is hiding out in the area. The sniper killed four people and wounded another in a shooting spree that began last night. Sergeant Richard Coffey with the Missouri Highway Patrol says the search for Johnson will continue.
It's going to be harder for the officers when night falls. We will still concentrate on following up on any possible leads that we might have and continue searching through the city.
The suspect is believed to be carrying several weapons. He is described as an excellent marksman. He also knows this area well. He grew up in a small town just north of here. Most businesses and schools closed today, and police are advising residents to stay inside and keep their doors locked. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Lohr in California, Missouri.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 8 points to close at 2,863.82. Declines led advances by a margin of about 3-2 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The inventor of the intermittent windshield wiper won a patent infringement case against another major automaker today. Robert Kearns, whose invention is used on virtually every automobile made, won his case against the Chrysler Corporation. The 63-year-old inventor had already won a long-fought case against Ford Motor Company, claiming that Ford stole his invention despite his patents. Kearns still has suits pending against 18 other automakers. A Chrysler spokesman declined to comment on the verdict today because another trial is set to begin in January to determine how much the company will pay in damages. Secret ballots are being counted today in the most Democratic election ever for the Teamsters Union. It's the final step in a 2-year government-imposed process aimed at ridding the nation's largest private sector union of corruption and organized crime influence. NPR's David Malpas reports.
Never before in labor history has the government gone to such lengths to ensure a fair and open union election, insisting on a vote by rank-and-file members with numerous restrictions to prevent fraud. Less than a third of the members mailed in ballots, but by any measure, the process already has transformed the Teamsters. Ron Carey, the candidate with the least ties to the Teamsters' old guard, promises to end excessive salaries and perks for union leaders. R.V. Durham, who has considerable establishment backing, supports an internal ethics committee. And Walter Shea, top assistant to four former Teamster presidents, also favors democratic reforms. The count will take several days. A close finish is expected. I'm David Malpas.
The executives who buy materials for the nation's factories predicted today that the economy is likely to recover slowly in the next year, but said there will be no double-dip recession. The National Association of Purchasing Management said that by a 3-to-1 margin, its members are expecting to see a 4.2% growth in economic activity in 1992. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Everywhere you turn these days, you hear stories about wage cuts and benefit losses. But one sector of society seems to be fairly well insulated from the crunch. They're the CEOs of America's largest corporations. For 20 years, Grave Crystal worked as a compensation consultant to these CEOs, winning them bigger and bigger wage and benefit packages. Fortune magazine called him America's foremost authority on executive compensation. But a few years ago, Crystal realized these executive packages were spinning out of control, and he switched sides. He's just written a book called In Search of Excess, The Overcompensation of American Executives. He also edits a newsletter, The Crystal Report, and is a columnist for Financial World magazine. Terry Gross spoke with him earlier this week.
You have compared CEOs to pharaohs. Let me ask you to make the comparison.
To pharaohs, certainly in the sense that they are paid a huge amount, as I assume the pharaohs were, that there are huge differentials between the pay of the pharaoh and the pay of his citizenry, the pay of a CEO and the pay of his workers, I should say. And in addition, I think when I made the comparison to pharaohs, I think of the sense of growing isolation of American CEOs of modern corporations. They no longer eat in the corporate cafeteria. They have private dining rooms. I even remember a CEO who went so far as to lure a French chef away from a major Manhattan restaurant and had to give him a 12,000 share stock option to do so, just so he could cook for this one person. So they come to work by limousine. The elevators are cleared out of the hoi polloi, or the hoi polloi, I should say, are cleared out of the elevators so that the CEO can ride up in solitary splendor. He's served by white-coated waiters all day long. He really meets no one except people on his same level and a few receptionists, a few secretaries, an elevator starter, and a chauffeur.
Maybe you can describe a CEO package that you think exemplifies what has gone wrong with the way we compensate CEOs.
I'm trying to think of a single package. Well, an example, and I don't mean to single him out, would be Rand Ariscog. Now, he's actually changing his behavior, so maybe it is a good example. In his case, here's a person, and I'm doing this by memory, but here's a person whose cash compensation...
Let me interrupt you. Yeah. He's the head of ITT.
The head of ITT. His cash compensation for 1990, I think, was on the order of $2.5-3 million in that area, and I have to be a little imprecise because I don't have my notes in front of me. He received about $4 million worth of free shares. Now, I don't mean by this option shares where the price has to go up for you to get a reward. He got the shares totally free, so even if the price dropped in half, he would still make $2 million. And he received some payouts under some so-called performance unit plans, supposedly based on the company's magnificent performance. Those were another few million. The total package, I do remember that number, came out to be $11.5 million for a single year's work. And the problem here are two problems. One is that it's an awesome size. And secondly, the company's performance has been rather poor. A company way down in the rankings by almost any measure. Maybe 70, 75% of companies doing better than this company. On other measures, maybe 80% of companies doing better. So here you have a package that was very high, obviously not responsive to performance, or he wouldn't have received this sort of money. Now, he was the subject, and ITT was a subject of withering criticism by me, by others, even by the major institutional investors, the California Public Employees Retirement System, which is the largest body of private capital in the United States, voted its million-plus shares against the re-election of the board to show its displeasure. And to his credit and to the credit of the board, the company is now moving to inject a considerably greater degree of risk into his pay package. Whether it's going to be smaller or not, we're told it may be, but I haven't seen the numbers yet.
What do you say to CEOs when, you know, when they say, well, how come you make so much? And they say, well, what's the big deal? You know, sports celebrities, Hollywood celebrities, they make more than we do.
Some years ago, a chief economist of the SEC, Ken Lane, who's now going back to academia, wrote a doctoral dissertation, and in it he tried to account for why one baseball player makes more than another. And he found that the baseball market is actually a pretty rational market. He found that he could account for 74% of the variation in baseball players' pay if he knew such things as their batting averages, or if they were pitchers, whether they won the Cy Young Award or had an ERA that was very outstanding, and things like that. So here was a market where 74% of the pay of the players was being driven by performance. And now I look at a study I just finished of 1,000 CEOs, and I find that at best, you know, the best thing I can find is to account for about 4.5% of the variation in pay based on performance. In other words, about 95% is unexplainable on the basis of performance. This is a market that is totally crazy. It is not rational. We pay huge amounts of money, and we aren't paying it for performance. And that's why people are very angry in a recession, because their pay is going down, and they look upstairs, and they see Mr. Big, and his pay is not going down. It's probably even going up, maybe not a lot, but the point is it should be going down a great deal. This person is negotiating for himself. That's nothing wrong with that, but he's negotiating against his friends, so to speak, on the board. The boards aren't negotiating with any vigor. And so the CEO gets a huge amount of money, and what's missing here is that the relationship between pay and performance is gone.
I'm interested in hearing your critique of what's wrong with big compensation packages, I mean huge compensation packages for CEOs. One of the things that you say is that it's making us less competitive. CEOs always talk about how we need to be more competitive, but compare the American CEO with their foreign counterparts.
Yeah, and that's a very important argument these days when we have... you know, we're engaged in such a tremendous battle with the Japanese and the Germans, just to name two countries. A CEO in Japan, for example, makes around 16, 17 times. I mentioned in my book, I think 16, 17 times. Interestingly, someone got mad when they read that, and they did a study, and they claim that the number is 25 times, and I'm wrong. But even if it were 25 times, let's just grant that it is 25 times. In Germany, in France, it's also about 25 times. England, maybe 32, 33 times. So here we have people earning 25, 35 times the pay of a worker. We come to the United States, and depending on what database you want to use, the lowest number you could probably find is 100 times the pay of a worker. I have some data that if you take big company CEOs, can get it up to 150 times the pay of a worker just for your average CEO. And now I know people will often say, and CEOs will defend themselves, and they'll say, well, you know, listen, I could double my salary and it would get lost in the rounding. First of all, the statement's an utter falsity, because if you're making 6 or 7 million, or you're Rand Ariscog and you're making 11 million, if you double his salary, it doesn't get lost in the rounding, even of IBM's earnings, which are far larger than ITT's. The second thing is it has this huge suck-up effect. I just finished a study on the plane last night when I was coming in, and I found statistically that if you give the CEO a $1,000 raise, you give the chief operating officer, the number two person, statistically a $400 raise. You give the chief financial officer a $250 raise. And you give the chief legal officer a $150 raise. So already, we're just talking about three more people in the organization. Already the $1,000 raise has turned into an $1,800 cost to the shareholders, and that's just for four people. we still have hundreds more to go. I don't mean to suggest that we're all going to get an extra $150,000. The effect's going to reduce rapidly. But still, maybe that $1,000 raise, by the time it cascades through the entire corporation, may cost $30,000, $40,000. And now we're talking about big bucks. And, you know, you say, well, if we're going to pay, if we're going to have hugely more costs for management, and that's what we're talking about here, if we're going to have hugely more costs for management, if we have productivity in return for it, performance, then that wouldn't be so bad. But, of course, I've already said to you that we can only account for 5% of the difference in pay on the basis of performance, so that isn't working right. We just have extra cost. In fact, studies I've done tend to show very conclusively that if you have very high costs, you have less performance, not more performance, less performance, because these are, after all, costs. And so then you say to yourself, well, if you're going to have much higher costs than the Japanese have for this particular component of labor and much higher, no extra benefits, then one of two things has got to happen mathematically. You either have to have less profits, you give your shareholders less, and that probably is the least likely explanation. The more likely one is the other explanation, which is you raise your prices. You raise your prices, and then what do? You lose market share, and then you start wondering why we're not competitive with the Japanese and the Germans. I don't mean to suggest that if we cut our pay of the top executive group that everything would be fine tomorrow. But, you know, we got to start somewhere. I find it sort of interesting that back in the early 80s, Lee Iacocca and others got up and exhorted the United Auto Workers to pull in their belt, and they said, look, we're dying from the Japanese. Why, their labor costs are much lower than ours. We've got to cinch up our belts. We've got to cut the pay of the rank-and-file auto workers, and indeed, the pay was cut. Now, you know, Mr. Iacocca needs to give the same speech in a huge auditorium, except this time all the people in the audience are not going to be the United Auto Workers. They're going to be his fellow CEOs.
If the high benefits and high compensation packages for CEOs don't parallel terrific performance, why are they getting that much? Why are their companies willing to pay them that much?
Well, partly it's an illusion that, in effect, what's happened, and I knew how this worked very much as a compensation consultant, the process seems to be rational in the sense that, I mean, think of it. Let's suppose that you were going to go out and try to hire a secretary. So presumably you would identify certain companies and you would try to find out what they pay their secretary. So you would have a sense of the market, what the pay levels were, and then you would advertise and you would hire your secretary. in the case of CEOs, the process is just the same. Companies identify other companies to compare to. For example, when I was a consultant to the H.J. Heinz company, the big food company, every other year, we would take some 25 companies. We'd look at, and the companies you'd think of. We'd look at Quaker Oats and Kellogg and General Mills and Ralston Purina and Philip Morris, companies like that, and Procter & Gamble. And we'd put them into a database, and we'd find out what the CEOs earned, for example. And we'd say, okay, here's the market. First of all, we made a presumption that there is a market here, which I wonder whether that's a correct presumption now. But we said, here's the market, here's the average pay, here's what the higher ones pay, here's what the lower ones pay. Now, right away we get into a problem here because most companies say to themselves, or most boards, they say, well, you know, we are not a bunch of pikers, especially not with the CEO, maybe with the workers, but not with the CEO. We're not pikers. Why, we're not going to pay less than the average. I mean, that would be an insult. We must pay the CEO at least the average. And in fact, I remember doing a study some years ago of 100 major companies, and I asked them the question. I said, if you had a set of data where you have people paid from X to Y and the average is in the middle somewhere, where would you want to position your CEO? And they said one-third of them said they wanted to pay above the average, about 15 to 20% above the average, because they thought that would help attract a better breed of manager. And the other two-thirds said they wanted to pay exactly at the average, and not one of them said they wanted to pay below the average. And if you think about that mathematically, if every year two-thirds of the companies are bound to pay, you know, want to go up to the average if they're below it, they don't come down to it if they're above, one-third want to be above it, you're never going to catch the numbers. They're just every year, they get bigger and bigger. And every year, people look at the survey and say, oh, my God, we're behind again. You know, we're going to have to give the poor bloke another raise. What they don't do are two other things. They don't, as I said in the book, you know, they don't look across the waters to what CEOs earn elsewhere. it never dawns on them to say, well, what, you know, if I'm the head of a of Chrysler, what do they pay that guy who runs Toyota? What do they pay that guy who runs Honda? What do they pay that guy who runs Volkswagen? And so I never look across the wires. And the other thing I do is I don't look down. I don't say, you know, what's happening to my pay versus the pay of the worker? People say, who cares? You know, let's just look at these 25 CEOs, and it looks like we got to give another raise. And meanwhile, the whole thing spirals out of control.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Grave Crystal, and he's a former compensation consultant. He used to consult on how much CEOs should get. Now he's a kind of critic of that process. He's a financial journalist and author of the new book, In Search of Excess, The Overcompensation of American Executives. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about why CEOs make so much money, and my guest is Grave Crystal, who's the author of the new book, In Search of Excess. Now, you've basically changed sides. You used to be a compensation consultant.
Yes.
You used to consult for corporations on what kind of compensation package and salary and so on should go to a CEO. Now you're consulting with stockholders, with institutional investors and pension funds, and you're trying to hold down the size of these CEO packages. Why did you decide to switch sides? What changed for you?
Well, first of all, let me just make a point of clarification. I don't do very much consulting of any sort. Probably, if I added it up, less than 10% of my income, which is greatly reduced from the days when I was a consultant, comes from any sort of consulting activities. Fundamentally, I'm a writer. So I'm not out actively, necessarily lobbying against companies to get their pay down for money. I'm basically writing as a critic of executive compensation. But when you ask me why I have changed, I think the reason is that as I had been in this field for so many years, it began to dawn on me slowly, because you know when you're a consultant, you work with one company at a time. You're not being paid to rise in a helicopter 1,000 feet above the scene of the battle and do a lot of analyses because nobody's going to pay for the helicopter ride. And but it began to dawn on me just sort of slowly that somehow this thing wasn't working right, that the system was not fair. And what offended me the most were companies that you would encounter, and I would hear from colleagues all the time about companies where if anything went wrong, you know, they call up and they say, there's something wrong with my compensation plan. And you'd say, well, what's that? And they say, well, it's not paying off. And you'd say, well, pardon me, but maybe that's the proof that this plan is working, that it's equating non-performance with non-reward. And so then they just get another consultant. So you began to get the idea that pay was just going out of control, getting higher and higher. We were adding plans on top of plans. Nobody was willing, with John Reed and a few other people as exceptions, hardly anybody was willing to cut their pay in hard times. So I began to feel that there's something intellectually dishonest about this whole process. And that sort of impelled me out into academia and into being a critic.
What suggestions would you make for reforming the system?
Well, the first thing is I think it's important to say what I wouldn't suggest. I wouldn't suggest getting in and having the government jump in and have some ham-handed attempts to control executive pay, like, for example, freezing it or saying you can't make more than the President of the United States or putting back a huge tax or something like that. I don't think any of those are probably going to be all that useful, and they could be very distorting to the markets. I mean, my own view of the world is to some relatively small suggestions, but I think they would help over time. I think the first thing that would be important is to improve the bargaining process between the CEO, who is selling his services, and between the board of directors, who are the people buying the services. The boards of directors need to be jump-started into action. These are not the owners of the company. They're the representatives of the owners. Most of them own like 5 shares or 100 shares or whatever. Their pay is insulates them from the company's fortune. And the boards of directors, who are often the friends of the CEO, are not pushing back. They are not saying, hey, wait a minute. If you want to earn $5 million, I mean, gee, that's a lot of money. I'll tell you what, Bill, give us a couple of months to think about it. And to be honest with you, Bill, during those couple of months, we're going to call a search firm and see if we can find someone who's as good as you to do the job for $2 million. And if we were to do that, you know, maybe we'd find that people would be able to take those jobs. I would mention to you parenthetically that if we threw open the bidding for the CEO's job in a truly competitive bidding process with honest people doing the evaluation, I could guarantee you that pay would fall tremendously. And the reason I can guarantee it to you is that there are so many talented women and talented minorities who have been kept out of the bidding process that if we open it to them, the economics would suggest the rate would have to fall tremendously. So I'm suggesting that, first of all, we need to push, have the boards push back. One of the things that I think very simply a board could do is to have its own compensation consultant. This field is very tricky. If you had a compensation consultant who worked for the board is his client or her client, that compensation consultant has no ties whatsoever with the company. I mean, it will not do for me to be the compensation consultant to the board and for my partner in my firm to be the actuary to the company, because right away we're in a conflict of interest. To have no ties, and incidentally, and when I make this recommendation, I'm not trying to set up an annuity for myself. I am not interested in doing that sort of work. I really want to write. But where you'd have someone meeting with the board every time the board meets and saying to the board, hey, do you really want to do this? God, that's an awful lot of money. Do you realize this incentive plan would pay this person $3 million even in bad performance? Did you consider that fact? That sort of thing. I think that would help the board to push back and to say to the CEO, you know, Bill, this really is sort of ridiculous and we can't go along with this. That's wonderful. That's what we need to do.
Now that you are no longer consulting to corporations, do you have a different sense of American business or American economics, or, you know, what fairness is in the workplace?
Yeah, I think so, because I've been forced to now to look at this sort of stuff. I see this huge yawning gap between the pay of workers. Workers' pay is going nowhere. In fact, it's gone down about 13% in after-tax inflation-discounted terms in the last 20 years or so. I see this yawning gap. And if the gap was engendered by tremendous performance and tremendous risk on the part of the CEO, that would be one thing. I mean, if it were like Lee Iacocca, in Lee Iacocca's life is sort of like a two-act opera, at least from a compensation standpoint. In Act One, our hero, comes in to save Chrysler, and he takes $1 a year. And he takes a huge set of stock options, and he says, look, if the company goes belly up, I'll make $1 a year, and that's all I deserve. And if we turn it around and we do beautifully, I'll make millions, and that's what I deserve. And he made about $44 million of stock option profits, and everybody thought he was a great hero. They wanted to run him for president because he took risk. He was paid based on his performance. The new Lee Iacocca in Act Two is turning Chrysler around, or trying to turn Chrysler around a second time. But in this second act of the opera, where most of the opera goers have left the auditorium by this point, because this part is not exactly so thrilling, our hero is working for like $1 million a year salary and huge bonuses and everything else, and he's not taking much risk at all. Well, that part I find just terribly offensive, because if we're going to have these gaps and they're not related to performance, then there's no rationale for them. I think workers themselves, I mean, when I talked about the $1,000 maybe costing $30,000, the part I can't measure is how workers feel about it, how people say, you know, I'm not going to try hard anymore around this place, because all they do is they lay us off, they cut our pay, they freeze our pay, and then they end up giving the top executives lots of money.
Well, Grave Crystal, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Grave Crystal spoke with Terry Gross earlier this week. He's the author of In Search of Excess, The Overcompensation of American Executives. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. Underground comics have generally been a male domain, but Twisted Sisters, a new collection of underground comics, documents the work of women artists who create cartoons with a feminist twist. Coming up, we meet one of the artists, Diane Newman. Also, world music critic Milo Miles plays some of what they're listening and dancing to on the other side of the world in Indonesia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Testifying today on Capitol Hill, CIA Director Robert Gates called the situation in the Soviet Union dangerously unstable. Gates told the House Armed Services Committee that current unrest in the country, tied to shortages of food and fuel, will create this winter the most noteworthy disorder since the Russian Revolution in 1917. Meanwhile, a spokesman for Soviet President Gorbachev has denied rumors that he plans to step down. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Early today, one of President Gorbachev's advisors fueled a flood of speculation about Gorbachev's future by hinting that there might not be a long wait for Gorbachev's resignation. The Soviet leader has been under intense political pressure since Sunday, when the leaders of Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine formed a commonwealth of independent states that leaves no role for Gorbachev. But his spokesman said that at least for today, the Soviet leader is not thinking of resigning. Gorbachev has rejected the Commonwealth plan as unconstitutional, but his spokesman said he would accept it if the parliaments of the individual republics accepted it. Ukraine's parliament adopted the plan overwhelmingly today. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down as unconstitutional a New York law that confiscates the profits that a criminal makes for a book or movie about his activities and sets the money aside for victims. The court's ruling voided New York's so-called Son of Sam law, named after convicted killer David Berkowitz, who was offered large sums of money for the rights to his story. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Writing for a unanimous court, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said the New York law is unconstitutional because it singles out speech on a particular subject for a financial burden that it places on no other speech and no other income. She acknowledged that the state does have a compelling interest in compensating the victims of crime, but the New York law, she said, is so broad that had it been in effect at the time, it would have blocked authors' profits from many of the great works of literature, among them the autobiography of Malcolm X, which includes an account of crimes the author committed as a young man, and Henry David Thoreau's Civil Disobedience, in which the author describes his refusal to pay taxes, and even the Confessions of St. Augustine, in which the author describes how he once stole pears from a neighbor's vineyard. Although today's Supreme Court opinion applies only to New York, some 30 states are said to have used the New York law as a model, and those state laws could be invalid, too. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
And the nation's highest court has ruled that aliens have to pay their own attorney fees in fighting efforts to deport them. That ruling came in a vote of 6-2. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 8 points to close at 2,863.82. This is NPR News. In the Netherlands, diplomats say that leaders of the European community have now reached agreement on a new economic and political union. Earlier, officials gave in to London and dropped labor regulations from the plan. Agreement was reached after long hours when the entire plan was in danger over Britain's refusal to accept common laws on labor rights. Winding up their two-day summit, the 12 leaders met into the early hours to wrap up details of their new agreement. Conservative commentator Patrick Buchanan has announced that he will challenge President Bush in the Republican presidential primaries. Lita Hartman with New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
Buchanan says he's running for president because Republicans can no longer blame liberals for the nation's problems. He says the differences between him and Mr. Bush have grown too deep.
He would put America's wealth and power at the service of some vague New World Order. We will put America first. And so, to take my party back and to take our country back, I am today declaring my candidacy for the Republican nomination for President of the United States.
Buchanan hopes to attract middle and working class voters of both parties, but some Republicans here are concerned that instead of pressuring Mr. Bush to move to the right, Buchanan will weaken him in the general election. For National Public Radio, I'm Lita Hartman in Concord, New Hampshire.
In London, officials investigating the finances of the late British publisher Robert Maxwell say more than $1 billion is missing from pension funds in companies controlled by the Maxwell family. A spokesman for a court-appointed accounting firm says that he has traced more than half of the missing money, but it's unclear how much of this will be restored to the pension accounts. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Diane Newman is among a small group of women cartoonists who come out of the underground cartoon movement of the 70s. She started drawing comics in 1972 for Women's Comics. That's Women's spelled W-I-M-M-E-N apostrophe S. Her work has appeared in such publications as Choices, Titters, Young Lust, Weirdo, and True Glitz. Newman is the editor of a new anthology of the work of women cartoonists called Twisted Sisters, a collection of bad girl art. When Newman assembled the book, she looked for cartoons that clearly reflected a female perspective. When Terry Gross spoke with Diane Newman, she first asked her what the title of the book meant.
Partly it means that the book is not politically correct. When I first started drawing comics, I was involved with a comics collective called the Women's Comics Collective, and it was the early 70s, and they were fairly rigidly feminist. And so bad girl art reflects that, as well as sort of an in-your-face attitude toward what is expected of women in society, kind of saying, well, we're not going to do that.
What were your reasons for joining a women's comic collective, and what was the idea behind it?
Well, I was just very fortunate. I had just started drawing comics. I didn't know anything about it. I met someone, Aileen Kaminsky, who was involved in this collection, and she told me to come to the first meeting. And so that I didn't have any particular interest in specifically being a woman cartoonist. It just sort of fell into it. There were some women who were having trouble getting printed and felt that the underground comic scene was kind of an all-boys club, and so this was their reaction to that. This is like the all-girls club.
Did you feel that way about it, and did you feel that any of the comics in the underground comics were sexist?
I didn't feel that way as strongly as some of the women who started this. I have a lot of my influences have been men cartoonists who I like and respect a lot of the work they did. Some of it was male sex fantasies. I don't know if I want to label that specifically sexist. Some of them were sexist, you know, in the official line, but people are entitled to their fantasies. And underground comics were there was a lot of freedom and personal expression going on at that time. And there was a feeling of, you know, Zap was definitely an all-boys club, but a lot of men couldn't get into it either. It was a very specific group of people that started a comic book, and they kept doing it, and they've been doing it for 20 years.
Can you describe for me what your comics were like then in the 70s?
Well, my comics evolved pretty quickly to center around a character I created called Dee Dee Glitz, who is a Brooklyn housewife with a blonde bubble wig, and she's a single mother, and she likes Mai Tais and Miami and mini skirts and leopard skin, and she has a reaction definitely to my teenage adolescent alienation when I was growing up in Canarsie, so Brooklyn.
Now, you not only draw comic strips with your character, Dee Dee Glitz, but you also do some autobiographical ones that are really very much about you. And I'd like to have you read one of those now.
Okay. That is actually, it's harder for me. My first time that I did a direct autobiographical strip, it was scary. It was like the first time I actually tried to do something sexual in a comic and do that. It's kind of frightening. And then it's fun once you break that barrier.
What was frightening about it being autobiographical?
Because it feels safe to hide behind a character. You can say whatever you want. You can make the character do whatever you want, but you can keep the illusion that people don't really know if it's you or not. So this story is called Coming of Age in Canarsie, a sociological study of primitive youth in Western civilization. When we moved from Long Island to Brooklyn in 1960, I had just turned 13, a very young 13. And I'm trying on my first bra and saying, "It hurts to run. I hate them. They jiggle." And my girlfriend saying, "She's so lucky." Overnight, I was thrust into the junior high school world of makeup, makeout parties, and BOYS. And we're dancing to In the Still of the Night. I grew up fast. Dear Diary, these bits of Sheila Shapiro's shag carpet are souvenirs from my very first spin the bottle game. I got kissed 18 times. I'll treasure them, but not quite fast enough. If you don't kiss me, I'll tell everyone you draw naked girls. This is a guy threatening me and holding a drawing I did. And I'm saying, I just didn't put on her bikini yet. She's not really naked. And I'm wearing a panty girdle under Bermuda shorts.
You got to mention here that the drawing that this guy's holding that you did is of a voluptuous naked woman in high heels.
Right. I guess I left that out.
Yeah.
This is based on a real event. This really happened. This guy tried to blackmail me into kissing him. Because I did used to sit in my backyard and just draw, and I think probably it was really true that I hadn't put her bikini on yet because I wasn't quite ready to draw naked girls. I learned to pretend I didn't study, to roll up my skirts, wear white lipstick, hang out in bowling alleys, and shoplift. And then there's a principal telling me, "Congratulations, Miss Rosenblatt, you placed in the highest percentile in the PSATs. Oh, and then I go back to the classroom and my friend says, "Psst, what did the principal want?" And I said, "I'm in big trouble." Which is really true, because if you were known as a brain, forget it. And I acquired on my first date with a college man that much coveted red badge of honor, the hickey. And then my mother is saying, "One moment, young lady, just what are you doing with those big red blotches all over your neck?" And I'm wearing the lowest cut possible blouse. And I'm saying, "Oh, mother, it's merely a rash."
There's a lot of hickeys that show up in your cartoons. This must have been a big thing when you were a teenager. Hickeys.
Well, it really was. It was kind of like, well, I finally, it's proof that you had made out with someone and that you weren't a kid anymore. But for me, I had to grow up in about a week and a half. I moved from Long Island to Canarsie, and Brooklyn had just completely different mores, and I was 13, and I had gone from just climbing apple trees and being a kid to having to go to parties and function. It was sink or swim.
So what are the things you had to learn how to do quickly? And how did you change how you dressed in order to fit in?
Well, I teased my hair. I wore white lipstick. I put on, I just matched whatever everybody else was doing. You know, you desperately want to fit in at that age. You just wear what they're wearing. And I was lucky, I guess. I learned how to do that. My sister had a harder time. She had a harder time fitting in.
We'll be back with more of Terry's interview with cartoonist Diane Newman after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Cartoonist Diane Newman is Terry's guest today. She's the editor of a new collection of women's cartoons called Bad Girl Art. She and Terry have been talking about some of Newman's own work.
I want to ask you to read another autobiographical comic. And this is one that you did just about a year ago. And it's about getting an abortion.
Yeah, well, this was for a comic that was a pro-choice benefit book called Choices. And it was actually difficult for me to do because I have no mixed feelings about being pro-choice, but I have mixed feelings about abortion at this time personally for myself because I'll read the story. It's called The C Word, And it starts in the waiting room at the Margaret Sanger Clinic. And I'm with my sister, and she's saying, "Thanks for coming, sis. I'm kind of nervous about getting this IUD." And I'm saying, you know, as long as I'm here, maybe I should get a pregnancy test. I'm really nauseous, and I haven't had my period for 2 months. The first year they made abortion legal in New York, I got pregnant. And then I was 22 and stuck in a loveless marriage, and my husband is saying, "Can't you do anything right? I told you these onions are supposed to be in uniform 1/16 inch slices." And I'm going, "Sorry," and crying as I'm slicing onions. So I was 22, stuck in a loveless marriage and not sure who the father was. And I'm having an affair with a guy, and I'm saying, "I was very upset in group tonight, Nick." "Yeah, me too. I can't believe Dr. Walbaum's deserting us just because her husband's transferred to D.C. And the guy was a true WASP prince, prone to leather pants. That was in my group therapy group. The next panel, I did what I had to do. It was easy. And I'm lying on a table with my legs in stirrups, and the nurse is saying, "You did really well. We want you to rest here for a bit. Do you have a ride home?" Years later, my marriage over, I found myself in front of a painting at the Modern, and I'm standing in front of a painting by Chelichu called Hide and Seek at the Museum of Modern Art, and the painting is, it's like a tree of life, and there are all these hidden babies and fetuses and heads all around a tree. And I, when I stood in front of that painting, all of a sudden I felt all the pain of the abortion that I had suppressed, so that was a very powerful experience for me. The pain and sense of loss I had long suppressed out of necessity flowed over me. And I went back to my room and I wrote a poem about it. And in the panel, I'm thinking the poem, which says, "Hurting tears my throat, clogging my nose, cleaning house, vacuumed a life away." Now, 20 years later, a happy marriage and 4 miscarriages later, I'm faced with infertility. And I'm saying Clomid, Pergonal, HCG shots, basal temperature charts, progesterone, private adoption, foreign adoption, surrogacy, in vitro, oy. Looking back, I'm grateful to that 22-year-old for her strength, and there are pro-choice demonstrators saying no more wire hangers and keep abortion legal, mobilize for women's lives. And then I'm at my drawing table drawing Dee Dee Glitz, and I say I owe my life to her choice. And then the definition of choice. 1, act of choosing, selection. 2, the right or power of choosing, option. 3, an alternative, synonym, choice, alternative, option, preference. All suggest the power of choosing between two things. Choice implies the opportunity to choose. That was a difficult strip for me.
Was it difficult because it was so personal, or because it got you to think about things you hadn't thought about in a long time?
Well, a combination. It was very personal, and it's painful to contemplate those subjects. It's certainly painful to think about having had an abortion when you're having problems with infertility. So that, yeah, it was painful. But I felt that the only way I could do a strip about pro-choice was to be honest and to do something about my own feelings about it, because that's what it's about. It's about each person's personal, hard, very difficult decision. And no one ever says that's easy.
Your last name, Newman, is spelled N-O-O-M-I-N. Is that instead of N-E-W-M-A-N?
Yeah.
Did you change it?
It's one of these things that happen to women who have more than one marriage, and you change your name the first time, and then you don't know what to call yourself if you get divorced. And I got divorced from my first husband, whose name was N-E-W-M-A-N, but I was used to calling myself Newman. I'd been calling myself that for a while. I didn't want to go back to Rosenblatt, which was my maiden name. And so I decided to spell it differently. In 1973, it was sort of spell it in a cartoony way. And I got stuck with it, which I don't know if I would have made the same choice today, because people think it's Noonan, or, you know, they read it wrong or whatever, but I'm stuck with it now. Once you've been published and you've used it, that's your name.
Right. Now, let me ask you about a quote on the back of Twisted Sisters, and it's a quote from Madonna, who says, "Finally, a book that makes me look wholesome." What's the story behind the quote?
Well, you know, I sent her a dummy of the book, hoping, you know, like just as a a shot in the dark that maybe Madonna, as the ultimate bad girl, would relate to the work and send us a quote. And we didn't hear anything for a really long time. And then just before the book is going to press, I get a phone call from her publicist who says, quick, send Madonna a copy. She's sitting bored in a trailer somewhere in Indiana shooting a baseball movie, and I think she'd like the book. So we sort of held the back cover presses and sent it off to her, and we got that quote back, which was, it was really satisfying. Great quote. A lot of people think we made it up because it's the perfect quote, but it was also satisfying because I had asked Sandra Bernhardt to give us a quote or to write an introduction, and she was very nice, but she said she was too busy and even bad girls had to work, so it was really nice to get a quote from Madonna.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Cartoonist Diane Newman is the editor of a new anthology of women's cartoons called Twisted Sisters, a collection of bad girl art published by Penguin. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. Pat Buchanan announces he's running for president. Disarray in the Soviet Union, or what's left of it. Linda Wertheimer reports on the closing of a glass factory in the small town of Ada, Oklahoma. Also, Thomas and Jean Sutherland. Tom was released as a hostage after 6.5 years. He was in southern Lebanon. Jean stayed on the campus of the American University of Beirut against the advice of the U.S. State Department. They explained that they thought they could help by working in Beirut when they went there in the first place, teaching agriculture and English. Tom Sutherland describes some of his time in captivity and also says he's not interested in seeing the United States seek retribution against the hostage takers.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio. In the 1940s and 50s, a man named Moses Ash operated Folkways Records from a tiny office in New York City. His back catalog included one of the first and most thorough collections of folk music from around the world. The label has been reborn as Smithsonian Folkways and continues Ash's work. World music critic Milo Miles says their most important contribution so far is an ambitious series on the music of Indonesia.
When people think of Indonesian music at all, they most likely think of the large percussion and gong ensembles known as gamelans. These very elaborate groups are really more like local classical orchestras in this country, and on a day-to-day basis, Indonesians listen at least as often to other kinds of music. Some of those styles are collected on Volume 2 of the Smithsonian Folkways series, which is Popular Music, Kroncong, Dangdut, and Langgam Jawa. Daun kelapa, jiwa manis, si daun kelapa. These modes are true world musics in that they include instruments and sounds adapted from distant modern cultures. In the case of Kroncong and its variation Langgam Jawa, the borrowed instruments include mandolin, guitar, cello, violin, and sometimes banjo. This easygoing sound is favored by a now aging generation of urban sophisticates who listen to it at gatherings where Kroncong functions as a kind of chamber music. What it sounds like to me, though, is a bizarre but fascinating far Pacific kind of country and western, with its sad voices, twanging sounds, and mournful delivery. The fancy Indonesian fans of Kroncong won't know if you use it to cry in your beer.
rybu, la rybu. Anak laman jangan. Anak, anak laman, jangan.
Perhaps Cronchong is woeful because it's nostalgic, and it does seem to be a popular style whose time is passing. Dangdut, on the other hand, is dynamic, constantly forward-looking, pushing the boundaries. In short, it's consciously hip. It's also the favorite music of the young Islamic population. Dangdut uses studio technology and high-tech instruments without shame as it combines rhythms and tones from New Wave rock, Middle Eastern pop, and Indian film music. Dangdut is thought of as wild stuff, and leading star Roma Irama tries to look very ferocious and leather-loving in his publicity photos on the CD cover.
Mencari teman memang mudah, apabila untuk teman suka mencari teman. Tidak mudah apabila untuk teman duka. Banyak teman di meja makan, teman waktu kita jaya.
Of course, to music fans accustomed to Public Enemy and Slayer, Roma Irama sounds quite even-tempered, even sweet. But that's Western standards. In the very calm, chaste realm of Indonesian pop, Irama is a firebrand, something of a social activist and a passionate Islamic advocate. Here is a song which exhorts listeners to read their Quran.
Dari masa ke masa, manusia berkembang peradabannya. Hingga di mana-mana manusia merubah wajah dunia. Gedung-gedung tinggi mencakar langit, nyaris menghiasi segala negeri. Bahkan teknologi di masa kini sudah mencapai kawasan samawi.
Dangdut can sound like a puzzle at first, but after a while, the simple pop pleasure of listening to it settles in. Like working-class anthems anywhere, Dangdut has a core of forthrightness you can grow to treasure. It's a music of confidence and pride. Dangdut announces that such classy touches as synthesizers and elaborate studio arrangements are no longer the property of wealthy superpowers or even large continental countries. The song of the future is ready for whoever will take it.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He reviewed Indonesian popular music on the Smithsonian Folkways label. Fresh Air is produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Shorrock, Joan Tui, and Susan Weinstein. Our researcher is Ellen Silva. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Sengaja ku sakiti hatimu, ku bercumbu di hadapanmu. Sengaja ku sakiti hatimu.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Philip Levine put in years working at the factory before he left it for his true calling, poetry. But factory work was so hellish, he's still writing about it. And his latest book, What Work Is, just won the National Book Award for Poetry. A talk with Philip Levine on the next edition of Fresh Air.